Illinois CPA Society.
May it please the court, Mr. Hardy. My name is Patrick O'Hara, and I represent plaintiff Tom Wetzler, who is a participant in the Illinois CPA Society and Foundation Retirement Income Plan. This case deals, of course, with the anti-cutback rule of ERISA, which is found at Section 1054G, Title 29 of ERISA, otherwise known as 204G of ERISA. I'd like to state briefly what the statute is, because it is a very brief section that's pertinent here. The statute says a plan amendment which has the effect of eliminating an optional form of benefit with respect to benefits attributable to service before the amendment shall be treated as reducing accrued benefits. I'd like to compare that with the circumstances of this case. Clearly, we have an amendment. Now, that's the Amendment 1 that was enacted by the society, the CPA Society plan, on June 24, 2004. Certainly, it deals with an optional form of benefit, because it's clear by the case law that a lump sum distribution with or without security is an optional form of benefit. And certainly, the optional form of benefit here in the CPA Society's plan pertains to benefits attributable to service before the amendment. Well, how do we know that? Well, we know that because the former highly compensated employee didn't have any service in 2004. Indeed, his last service was performed in terms of accruing benefits back in 2002 when he retired.
So what is the plan language that you're relying on that says that this lump sum payout was available prior to the amendment?
Well, it's either, we're indicating that Amendment 1 either affirmed that a lump sum distribution was available to highly compensated employees with security, or conferred it.
Now, are you saying that it affirmed it because of the payment that went out to this one individual?
Yes. Now, there wasn't a proscription with respect to it in the plan.
I see.
And the amendment itself allowed someone who had accrued benefits prior to the amendment to avail himself of that lump sum distribution with security.
Which they take the position was a mistake. We corrected the mistake, and you want them to allow that mistake to be given to everyone else?
Well, it's not a question of whether it was a mistake or not, or how they addressed it, because, again, there was an easy way to address a mistake, and that was simply to require the former HCE to remit his distribution back to the plan. But they didn't choose to do it. They didn't choose to address it that way. They addressed it by way of an amendment that referred to distributions and referred to accrued benefits that were attributable to service prior to the amendment.
Well, they addressed it by giving the assurances that the IRS would require them to give, which was the security.
Well, I'm not quite sure that the IRS gave them its imprimatur as to the application of this amendment.
No, I don't think that's in the record, but that was their basis,
that
right?
That was their intent. But again, I think we have to interpret the what is occurring in this case by virtue of what the application of this amendment by the plan, and whether, first of all, that violates ERISA's anti-cutback rule, and whether it's arbitrary and capricious. I don't believe you can address a mistake by simply pass an amendment and say, oh, never mind about that amendment, about that mistake, and that we made a mistake, but don't worry about it. That's not how it's addressed. It has to be addressed so that it's in conformity with the law and doesn't discriminate against the other plan participants.
But it wouldn't be in conformity with the law if it wiped out the benefits for the other plan members by giving the lump sum, would it?
Well, again, but that's the purpose for the security in the first place. If a letter is credit, credit is given by a highly compensated employee, and if there's a problem in terms of the fiscal integrity of the plan, then the plan can call upon that letter of credit or that security to shore up the finances of the plan. That's why it's not a violation in the first place. So it certainly wouldn't threaten the fiscal integrity of the plan, and that's why the IRS does not find by its revenue ruling of 9276 that it does not violate the what was being addressed by the Treasury regulation to prevent or restrict, restrict the lump sum distributions to highly compensated employees, as long as adequate security was given therefore. So the question we have is whether this Amendment 1, enacted on June 24, 2004, eliminated the optional form of benefit, the lump sum distribution with security, that was available for my client Tom Wetzler, and refused him. Now, I think it needs to be noted with emphasis here that the accrued benefits of Mr. Wetzler were the very same accrued benefits that the former highly compensated employee earned as well. There's no distinction in the plan between the accrued benefits of my client and that other HCE.
Now, they say that was a mistake, an error.
Pardon me?
They blame it on the actuary for giving out that first one. Therefore, they had to either rescind it or at least get it secured. They weren't going to do the same thing wrong a second time. I guess that's their argument.
Well, I don't think it's a question of, I don't think it's wrong to permit someone to have a lump sum, a highly compensated employee, have a lump sum distribution with security. That's what Revenue Ruling 9276 is all about. So they wouldn't be repeating anything that's a violative of the law. They're just refusing to allow Mr. Wetzler, my client, to have the same availability as the former HCE that availed himself of the amendment.
Well, he concedes, though, it was improper, that payment was improper, doesn't he?
No. That what was improper was giving him a lump sum distribution without security. That's what was improper. And so they had to do something to correct that. So they amended their plan that said you can have a lump sum distribution with security. And they had to go back to that highly compensated employee and say, give us the security now, 2 years after the fact. And what my client is saying is that I just want a lump sum distribution, and I'm willing to offer security just like the former highly compensated employee that's similarly situated with me.
Now, didn't a third person come along and say maybe he wants one too?
Yes, and I think that's available. And again, I don't know that poses any threat to the plan because that was the purpose, that is the purpose for the idea of security or a letter of credit.
But after four or five of those with maybe 50 people who are potential beneficiaries, there's no assets left in this plan. It has about
They draw upon those letters of credit to make certain that the plan remains solvent. That's the whole purpose for the security. But again, that's what's peculiar about this is that presumably the plan would have to draw upon all the former HCEs who put up letters of credit and draw from their securities equally and not discriminate between them. Now we have a situation where only one HCE gets that benefit of having the lump sum distribution with security and no one else gets that, even though the accrued benefits are identical when they were earned. Now, I would note that this is not at all dissimilar to the case of Ong versus All Steels, Inc. That was ruled by this circuit, I believe, in 1996. This court stated that the anti-cutback rule applies when a plan's amendment adversely affects a benefit of a participant who satisfies either before or after the amendment the pre-amendment conditions for the benefit. Now, that doesn't make any sense at all if that concept of pre-amendment conditions refers or pertains to something other than the service for which the benefits are attributable. Because in Ong, the plan was attempting to refuse the claimants because they hadn't retired by March 31st, 1991. They'd never be able to retire before that particular date. But this court ruled that they had to be allowed to grow into those because they had the same accrued benefits as those people who got to avail themselves of that amendment. That's no different than this case in terms of saying that they have to receive distribution before July 1st, 2004. It gives a factor that my client can't possibly meet. It's not a factor attributable to service, and that's what makes it violative of the anti-cutback rule. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hardy?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is William Hardy. I represent the appellees in this matter, the Illinois CPA Society and Foundation Retirement Income Plan, and the plan administrator. Your honors, your questions get to the heart of the matter. You're absolutely right. What Mr. O'Hara wants to do here is apply this mistake to all HCEs. This was a mistake. The former CEO was not entitled to a lump sum distribution. It happened. We found out about it in April of 2004. At that time, counsel was hired. Consultation with the board occurred, and the amendment was passed. That was the purpose of the amendment. No other HCEs prior to the former CEO had retired. No other HCEs had retired as of the point when Mr. Wetzler wanted to retire. And you're absolutely correct, Justice Mannion, that an additional HCE came forward while they were working through this process and some of the requests for amendment by Mr. Wetzler, and also wanted a lump sum distribution. And that's really the key to this, Your Honors. This is a small plan. I mean, this plan has 60-some-odd members. Only three of them were receiving benefits, were retired or separated and receiving benefits as of the time Mr. Wetzler applied or sought retired, excuse me. 46 of them were active, and there were, I think, 12 that were retired or separated and entitled to future benefits. So the committee, the administrative committee, the plan administrator in this case, was concerned, obviously, about non-HCEs. The very purpose of these anti-discrimination provisions is to prevent what happened here, a lump sum distribution to a HCE when the plan is underfunded, is discrimination against non-HCEs.
Would you address the Ong case then? Because I guess the risk in the analysis in Ong is that you would potentially favor or discriminate against one individual in giving them this benefit that wouldn't be available for others.
Well, a couple of points about Ang. First of all, Ang dealt with the legal issue and overruled a previous decision based primarily on amendments to the code, which made it clear that if you eliminated an optional form of benefit or an early retirement benefit that had accrued prior to the amendment, then that would be an anti-cutback violation. But that just begs the question. The question here is whether he was entitled to that benefit before or after the amendment, and he wasn't. Neither was the former CEO. The other point about Ang is that if you read that decision through the conclusion, the court really never got to the factual issue. One of the arguments the plan was making was that it should be affirmed on other grounds because this really wasn't a material change to the plan, and the court remanded that on that factual issue. Now, the facts in this case are undisputed. This was a mistake. I mean, it's in the board minutes, it's in the affidavits, it's in the plaintiff's own correspondence. You know, we laid out the facts in some detail in our brief, and Mr. O'Hara attempts to take us to task on that in the reply brief by saying, oh, we're citing to all these irrelevant facts that have nothing to do with the issue. The reason we did that is because of the way this case progressed. The plaintiff filed suit against us saying in his complaint Number one, I retired on as of this date. I requested a lump sum in November of 2006. That was denied. I requested it with security later on, and he argued that that was an anti-cutback violation and it was arbitrary and capricious and so forth. He then filed a motion for summary judgment, basically laying out the facts in what I think were in an accurate fashion, and arguing the same thing, that he was entitled to summary judgment. We felt it very important to lay out the facts as they actually occurred. I mean, what happened in this case is there was an erroneous distribution that shouldn't have occurred. The prior CEO wasn't entitled to a lump sum distribution in 2002. Mr. Wetzler wasn't entitled to a lump sum distribution in 2002. What happened was in 2004, they were faced with this decision, and the committee certainly struggled with it, and they did, upon the advice of legal counsel, pass this amendment, which clearly applied only to this prior HCE who should not have received it in the first place. Now, Mr. O'Hara says, well, they should have just required that he return that money. That's what they should have done. I'm not aware of any case law that deals with that, but that's easier said than done. I mean, we've got 2 years before that. This guy gets a lump sum. The record doesn't indicate how much it was, but let's say it's the $332,000 that Mr. Wetzler wants. If we're talking about $332,000 that was rolled over into an IRA and is now in all these other investments, or the guy's bought a house or whatever, it's you can't roll back the clock on something like that. Well, but certainly the committee was exercising discretion when it was considering these facts, which I think the plan clearly allows it to do. And the committee said, well, we've got this revenue ruling. We're going to adopt it for the sole purpose of correcting this erroneous distribution that should not have occurred. With respect to Mr. Wetzler, there's no question that he wasn't entitled to it before or after the amendment. There's simply no anti-cutback violation here as a matter of law. The facts are undisputed on these issues. And, you know, the facts that we have laid out in our brief, I just have to emphasize, were not countered with counter-affidavits or any other evidence. I mean, these facts as they developed, and, for example, the amendments that he requested, now they're apparently saying those things are totally irrelevant. The complaint alleges in November I requested a lump sum distribution, but now they're saying, well, none of that's relevant. We just look at the actual language of the amendment and the fact that I was willing to post security. What he requested in September was a side agreement with some form of partial lump sum distribution on an annual basis. And then in November, that amendment, he requested that that amendment be reconsidered. And there were a series of letters and so forth. He then tried to request a lump sum distribution in January and crossed out the escrow stuff. But the effect of this on this particular plan, Your Honors, would be devastating. As you pointed out, Your Honor, we've got two HCEs now. This plan had a little over $2 million in it at the time of Mr. Wetzler's retirement, I think $2.4 million. Well, the undisputed evidence indicates that when the committee considered that amendment, they were considering the fact that not only do we have Mr. Wetzler's $332,000, but we've got this other HCE who's retired, so we're looking at over $600,000. That's a quarter of the plan's assets. If another HCE retires, then you've got this small plan liquidating major portions of its investments to accommodate these HCEs. And I just have to, I can't emphasize strongly enough, Your Honors, that these anti-discrimination provisions are to prevent exactly this. Mr. O'Hara does not respond to our argument in our brief, in his reply brief, that these regulations are specifically designed to deal with situations where HCEs are treated in a way that by law substantially discriminates against non-HCEs. And that's all the committee was trying to do here. The committee was exercising its discretion, and I think it was entirely appropriate what the committee did. Judge Mim carefully analyzed this case, and I think there is an element of discretion in the plan's determination of the provisions of the plan. It was intended to comply with Section 401A. Mr. O'Hara, in his brief, says at one point, if the regulations and Section 401A are the only relevant authorities, which they were at that time, then it's prohibited. And it was prohibited. So, and I would also point out one other thing. You know, these regulations relating to HCEs are unique. Let's just say, for example, let me give you a hypothetical. If, I'm sorry, Judge, I'm running out of time. Can I have just 30 seconds to conclude?
30 seconds.
Okay. Let's say that the former CEO received that lump sum distribution at a time when the plan wasn't underfunded. There'd be no problem with that. It wouldn't violate the regulations. Let's say it was underfunded then the next year. Well, Mr. Wetzler wouldn't be entitled to it because by law, when it's underfunded, it's no longer available. So we think the judge's decision is right on point. The facts are undisputed, and we ask that this court affirm the well-reasoned decision of Judge Mim. Thank you, Your Honors.
You have 1 minute. I'll give you a minute and 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, I'm somewhat incredulous to hear that Mr. Hardy is indicating that with regard to the getting a remittance of the former HCE's lump sum distribution, he indicated that that's not as easily done as said. Well, that's the whole purpose of the letter of credit. I'm taken back that the inadequacy of the letter of credit here may be at issue, because that's what the whole purpose is to make certain that the plan can get that money back from an HCE who's received a lump sum distribution with security. And so I take it with a grain of salt when he indicates that it's difficult to get it back, because it's supposed to be very easy to get back in order to protect the plan. Now, with regard to... Pardon me?
This letter of credit where the plan can draw on it.
Yes.
So they had whatever $330,000 or something. They've got a letter of credit, basically borrowing it from the bank, or I guess the beneficiary is borrowing it.
Sitting there in the bank, and if the plan is can't meet its obligations, and it can draw upon that letter of credit. That's the whole purpose of it.
The first beneficiary owes the money.
That's correct. That is correct. Now, with regard to the so-called disputed facts, the district court found that the facts aren't disputed. So I'm not sure what Mr. Hardy is attempting to get at with regard to this outlay of all these facts. Most of them, I think, are immaterial to the issue at hand, because I think the plan is trying to indicate is, gee, we've made a mistake. Can you help us bail us out, even though the amendment that we've passed isn't fair? It discriminates not against HCEs, but among HCEs, because it doesn't treat each HCE the same. Two HCEs or three HCEs who have the very same accrued benefits are being treated differently and discriminately. And so simply they're asking you is that we made a mistake. Can you help us out with an amendment that doesn't say or is applied the way that it is written? It is written a certain way, it's unambiguous, and it ought to apply across the board non-discriminatorily in a way that doesn't violate the anti-cutback rule. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks again to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.